Hello, and welcome to the Herodotus Podcast. This is episode 12, The Fall of Sardis, book 1, chapters 79 to 84. Last time on the podcast, Croesus made his opening move against the Persian king Cyrus, marching into the neighboring kingdom of Cappadocia, which the Persians had taken from his brother-in-law. But after battling the Persians to a stalemate at Pteria, Croesus retreated back to his capital, Sardis. Intending to wait for spring and give his allies time to arrive, he dismissed many of his troops, with the expectation that he would have no need of them in the meantime. However, he was warned by divine portent that his capital would soon be captured. And that's where we resume our story. After Croesus retreated from Pteria, Cyrus got word of the Lydian king's intention to disband his army. Now, Cyrus, as we'll soon see, was no dummy. He knew that if Croesus had weakened his forces, it was to his advantage to attack as soon as possible. Therefore, leading his army personally, the Persian king marched into Lydia, heading directly to Sardis. Now, throughout the past 6 or 7 episodes, we've seen Herodotus be fairly harsh towards Croesus, and I myself have made a number of less than complimentary remarks about the king of Lydia. But you have to give credit where it's due. As Herodotus says, "And so Croesus, even having come to these dire straits, since everything had turned out contrary to his own expectations, nevertheless led the Lydians into battle. Impulsive and unreflective though he might have been, Croesus was no coward." And Herodotus goes on to add this bit of detail. "At this time there were no people in Asia braver or more courageous than the Lydians. They did battle on horseback, carrying long spears, and excelled in their horsemanship." In other words, the cavalry was the key component in the Lydian army, which had enjoyed great success up until now. The two armies met on the wide plain outside Sardis. As he watched Croesus's cavalry come into formation, Cyrus became apprehensive. He wondered whether his Persian army would be up to the task of confronting these famed Lydian horsemen. But then one of his advisors, a Mede by the name of Harpagus, came up with a clever idea. Following Harpagus's advice, Cyrus brought together all the camels that he had been using as beasts of burden in his army's baggage train. He ordered armed soldiers to be seated upon them, just as if they were horses, and he placed them in front of his army, commanding them to advance against the Lydian cavalry. As soon as the Lydians' horses smelled and saw the camels, they bolted, fleeing in terror. In one stroke, Croesus had been deprived of the most effective weapon in his arsenal, and suddenly Cyrus had the upper hand. Although this crafty move may have put the Lydians at a great disadvantage, they were, nevertheless, still fierce warriors. The cavalrymen did not hesitate to leap from their fleeing horses and battle the Persians on foot. A long and bloody fight ensued, but in the end, the loss of their cavalry was just too much for the Lydians to overcome. In spite of their martial prowess, they were driven back inside the walls of Sardis, and the Persians laid siege to the city. Croesus now assumed that he was in for a lengthy siege. So he sent messengers to his allies, urging them to forget the previous plan of meeting in the spring, but rather to hurry to Sardis as soon as they could. Among his allies, we can't forget, were the Spartans. And now Herodotus turns back towards Greece to show us what was going on with them while Sardis was being attacked. What was happening was this. Sparta had come into conflict with the city of Argos over a piece of land called Thyrea. This was an area of fertile plain on the eastern coast of the Peloponnese and part of Argive territory. The Spartans had invaded it, and of course the Argives wanted it back, since otherwise the Spartans would have cut them off from more of their own territory to the south and to the west. After some deliberation, the two cities came to an agreement. Rather than fight an all-out battle, each side would choose 300 fighters. These hand-picked forces would fight, and whichever elite squad was victorious would win Thyrea for their city. Fair enough. Except for one small problem. Nobody bothered to define what victorious meant. The Argive and Spartan soldiers were evenly matched and fought all day. Finally, by the time night fell, only three soldiers were left alive. Two Argives, named Alcanor and Chromios, and one Spartan, named Othryades. Alcanor and Chromios, assuming that two beat one, went home to Argos to announce their victory. Othryades, meanwhile, stayed behind on the battlefield and even stripped some armor from the Argive dead to shore up his defenses. When the armies of the two cities returned the next day, they both claimed victory. The Argives, because two of their soldiers had survived, as compared with one Spartan, and the Spartans, because their soldier had stood his ground while the Argives had retreated. Ironically, this dispute couldn't be resolved in any way other than war. So the two cities ended up fighting a full battle, the very thing they had sought to avoid. The Spartans were victorious. The Argives, however, greatly aggrieved, pledged that until they got Thyrea back, their women would wear no gold jewelry, and their men would shave their heads, since before this, their custom was to always wear their hair long. The Spartans, masters, it would seem, both of warfare and of trolling, made a corresponding pledge that thereafter they, who had always shaved their heads, would wear their hair long. In the end, Othryades couldn't bring himself to return to Sparta in shame, as the sole survivor of a troop of soldiers who had otherwise fallen gloriously in battle. So he joined his comrades in death, killing himself there at Thyrea. All this had concluded when a Lydian messenger came to ask for the Spartans' aid. The Spartans rushed to prepare their ships to bring help to their dear ally Croesus. But soon thereafter, a second messenger arrived, announcing the capture of Sardis. So the Spartans, with deep regret, figured there was nothing more that they could do, and ceased their preparations. Now, how did Sardis fall? Through bad luck and, if you can believe it, another botched prophecy. After 2 weeks of laying siege, Cyrus became anxious to take Sardis, and so he promised a reward to the first soldier to scale the city's wall. This inspired one of the soldiers, Heroiades by name, to try to climb the steepest and most inaccessible part of the city's walls. No guard had been set there, since to the Lydians it seemed, quite reasonably, like the safest part of the defenses. Remember that Sardis, like Athens and indeed like the vast majority of ancient cities, had an enclosed citadel, an acropolis, at the highest and most defensible part of the city, surrounded by walls. Heroiades was inspired to try this imposing-looking section of the defenses because he had seen a Lydian soldier descend from the city, right at that part of the wall, in order to retrieve a dropped helmet and then ascend again. There must be, Heroiades reasoned, some way to get up to the citadel there. He tried it, and soon found himself atop Sardis's walls, with other Persian soldiers close behind. Exploiting this secret weakness in the city's defenses, the Persians poured in and finally captured the Lydian capital. But Herodotus informs us of the real reason that Heroiades was able to get into the citadel at that point. I'll let the historian explain it for himself, referring to the rugged, inaccessible section of the city's walls where Heroiades ascended. The historian says, "This was the only spot where Meles, the former king of Sardis, had not carried the lion cub that his concubine had borne to him, as the Telmessians had declared that, should the lion be carried around the city walls, they would be impregnable. So Meles carried it around the rest of the walls, where the Acropolis was vulnerable to assault, but overlooked this spot, as it was steep and not attackable." Of course, the old not carrying the lion cub born from a human woman around the entire city wall error. How could we have possibly overlooked that one? Hi, everyone. Despite the recent long hiatus, I am still actively working on the podcast, and I'm creating a backlog of episodes that I can release over time on a regular basis. This is a passion project for me, and your support means the world. If you're enjoying this, please rate the Herodotus podcast 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or whatever platform you use. You can also help support the podcast on Patreon by going to patreon.com/HerodotusPodcast. And of course, you can always drop me a line at HerodotusPodcast@gmail.com. As always, thank you all so much. There are just a few topics I want to break down today. The first relates to the question that I suspect many of you have been asking yourselves for at least a few minutes now. Do camels really terrify horses? Bearing in mind that I'm not any kind of animal expert, after some research, the answer appears to be sorta. Horses have a very acute sense of smell, and camels have, well, a very strong odor. Camels stink for a number of reasons, primarily because they regurgitate their food and because they urinate on their own legs in order to stay cool. What's worse, during mating season, male camels have glands that excrete a foul-smelling, hormone-laden liquid, and a sac that emerges from their throat to dangle outside their mouth, memorably described by the Australian writer Robin Davidson as, quote, "a hideously repulsive pink, purple, and green balloon, covered in slobber and smelling indescribably foul, that female camels perversely find attractive." So, Herodotus wasn't entirely making things up here. It seems possible that horses would almost certainly react if downwind from camels, but it wouldn't have been the sight, rather the smell, of those camels that won the Persians the battle. Now, let's shift to looking at Herodotus's description of the Battle of Thyrea. There's something slightly strange about this digression, narratively speaking. Did you notice? From the way the story is set up, you'd expect Herodotus to tell us that the Spartans were too busy working out their boundary dispute with the Argives to come to Croesus's aid, and that their absence contributed to his defeat. But that doesn't happen. No, the Spartans were gearing up to head over to Lydia until the second messenger arrived to tell them that the Persians had already won. So even if they hadn't been involved with the dispute at Thyrea, the exact same thing would have happened. As always, we have to look at each incident in the histories in terms of the whole. Now, this is hard to do when we're going through the text slowly and in order, but much later down the line, when the Spartans will be called upon yet again, a delay will occur with significant consequences. I will no doubt remind you of the Thyrea incident when we get there, but I thought I should mention it now, The architecture of the histories is complex, and stories that echo or resemble each other reoccur from the very beginning to the very end. There's also the matter of the change in Spartan and Argive hairstyles after the battle. I joke that the Spartans were trolling the Argives by changing their hairstyle, but there's a little more than that going on here. As in many cultures, in ancient Greece, hairstyle and hair length were tied up with the ritual of mourning. It was not unusual to rend or cut one's hair as a sign of mourning, which is clearly what the Argives were up to here, lamenting their loss, unfair in their eyes, of Thyrea. The same motivation is behind the ban on women wearing gold jewelry. Mourners often make themselves look plain and humble as a sign of having given themselves over completely to remembering the dead. But then, what about the corresponding Spartan hair change? Most scholars see these comments of Herodotus as an explanation, a just-so story, for why Spartan soldiers wore their hair long, as they did. Long hair, much like a beard, was a sign of virility in ancient Greece, going all the way back to Homer. In the Iliad, there are numerous references to Achilles' long hair, and one of the stock descriptions of the Greeks is the long-haired Achaeans. The Spartans themselves, according to the Spartan-friendly historian Xenophon, attributed their hairstyle to Lycurgus, because of course they did. As Xenophon puts it, Lycurgus thought that long hair would make the Spartans look taller, freer, since you can't do menial work with hair in your eyes, and more terrifying. Remember that tip next time you visit your stylist. And very briefly, I really don't know what to tell you about the Lydian king Meles and the lion cub. This incident has long puzzled scholars. What we can say is that lions were often associated with royal power. Anybody who has traveled to Mycenae and seen the Lion Gate there will understand that association. Furthermore, a woman giving birth to an animal, not that this ever actually happened, would have been seen as a very ill omen indeed. So perhaps Meles, using it as a way of protecting his city, was doomed from the very start. At the least, it's a memorably weird story for Herodotus to recount, and the incident reminds me of the Byzantine practice of parading an icon of the Virgin Mary, the Virgin Ologetria, around the walls of Constantinople to keep the city safe, a practice that worked very well for many centuries, up until it didn't. In any case, the Persians are in Sardis, and all is lost for the Lydians. Next time on the podcast, we will, sadly, be wrapping up our time with our dear friend Croesus. Will he face defeat and death with equanimity and sober wisdom? The answer may surprise you. See you next time on the Herodotus Podcast.